Oyez, oyez, oyez. A person's having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3012, United States of America versus Roger S. Lathern, appellant, Mr. Seidel for appellant, Mr. Hill for appellee.
Good morning. Please. May it please the court, my name is Gary Seidel. I represent Roger Lathern. Mr. Lathern appeals the denial of his 2255 motion, which contended that his trial attorney, Gene Johnson, was ineffective. The ineffectiveness resulted from Mr. Johnson's failure to provide a plea offer to Mr. Lathern until weeks after the jury's verdict of guilty while going over the pre-sentence report. Mr. Lathern was then at jail, having been stepped back upon the return of the guilty verdict. Previously, Mr. Lathern had been able to go to Mr. Johnson's office. We submit that the district court's conclusion, finding Mr. Johnson and only Mr. Johnson a credible witness at the two evidentiary 2255 hearings, was error, particularly in the face of contrary testimony from three other witnesses: Mr. Lathern, the co-defendant, and the co-defendant's lawyer, Tony Axum, of the Federal Public Defender Service.
Okay, it's got to be more than error, though. It's got to be clear.
I would submit, Judge Henderson, it is clear error, not only on the basis of Mr. Johnson's own testimony, but the contradiction provided by Mr. Axum.
Yes, but for there to be plain error, so you agree it is plain error review?
I would contend it is clear error on the credibility determination.
Well, but we're at plain error review. I think that's what Judge Henderson asked you, right? Because the issue wasn't raised in the district court.
I submit that the issue of credibility was raised before Judge Walton.
No, but what about the issue of whether or not Judge Walton could consider? I thought what you were saying is, I thought your argument was that he had considered his past respect for Johnson in his calculations of credibility. Isn't that your point?
I have 2 points, Judge Tatel. My response to Judge Henderson first was clear error with a credibility assessment. The fact that Judge Walton originally said he was relying on his 25 to 27 years prior experience with Mr. Johnson, extra record information not addressed during that hearing, is, I would submit, clear error. It was consideration of...
Wait, but if the issue wasn't raised in the before Judge Walton, then our review of that issue is for plain error, right?
Agreed.
Okay.
I would submit, however, it was raised before Judge Walton, and indeed, Judge Walton's statements of the June 2010... Not a trial.
It was raised at the COA proceeding.
It was raised, in fact, in a pleading following his original denial of the 2259 pleading, which is the government's appendix.
Isn't that too late?
I would submit that it's not, because Judge Walton expressly incorporated a consideration of subtracting his knowledge of Mr. Johnson historically, as he expressly mentioned at the June 2010 COA hearing.
Isn't that a bit much of what, from the record, appears to be just musings by the judge? I mean, he raised the issue, thought about it. No one picked up on it. No one argued it. I mean, it's an interesting issue, but it wasn't raised.
Well, I would submit that it wasn't expressly objected to at the January 27, 2009, second evidentiary 2255 hearing. It was raised in the pleading filed April 30th, 2009. Judge Walton expressly incorporated that in his ruling in denying a certificate of appealability in June 2010. The case disappeared for 15.
In any event, didn't Judge Walton make clear that his final decision was not influenced by this at all? He said setting it to one side. Didn't he go out of his way to make clear that there's no...
He did indeed say that he was subtracting that information from his calculus.
And so you think he didn't succeed in doing that? What more would he have needed to have said?
What he did say was that he did not believe he could divorce himself from the knowledge he had obtained over a quarter century.
Before, he finally said, look, I'm putting it to one side and I'm not relying on that.
Well, he did say it before, about 20 pages before in the transcript. The problem, however, is that he did say it. And if he can't divorce himself, we're not talking about...
He asked aloud whether he could, and then at the end he obviously thought he could. He said, I'm putting it to one side.
Let's assume for argument's sake, Judge Griffith, that he did put it aside, was capable of putting it aside, and didn't consider his observations that Mr. Johnson very, very rarely went to trial in cases before Judge Walton. Notwithstanding, his determination of Mr. Johnson's credibility, I would submit, is not supported, indeed contradicted by the record evidence, not only of Mr. Johnson's own...
I thought he went out of his way to state all the reasons why he was credible.
Well, some of the reasons that he stated for his finding of credibility, I would suggest, seem to set up straw men. For instance, he knew what the ethical obligation was to communicate a plea offer, and of course he would have complied with that. There was no testimony by anybody about any particular ethical obligations or Mr. Johnson's compliance with them. Indeed, Mr. Johnson's own testimony, when this issue was first raised by Mr. Lathern himself at sentencing, November 16, 2005, I would suggest tips his hand. In the appellant's appendix, when Mr. Lathern, before Judge Walton, says he never received a plea offer and asked Mr. Johnson why not, the response was, they made one, we weren't going to accept it, we were going to trial. Mr. Johnson responds by saying, at page 61 of the appendix, line 20, quote, I went to Mr. Lathern and told him what the plea offer was. Subsequently, the next page, appendix 62, Mr. Johnson says, I don't know how many times, but I have the record of the number of times I came to see you. The problem with that information, I would submit, is that Mr. Lathern was on the street until late August, the return of the guilty verdict. Mr. Lathern went to Mr. Johnson's office every single time any contact was necessary outside the courthouse. Mr. Johnson never went to see Mr. Lathern until Mr. Lathern was incapable of getting out of the jail for a legal visit. Mr. Johnson, I would submit, on the first time this matter is raised, November 2005, says he told Mr. Lathern when he went to see him, the only way that was physically possible was post-conviction, which I would submit supports our contention, Mr. Lathern's indeed contention, that he didn't first find out about any plea offer until it was way too late.
The question is less of who visited whom, when, and where, as to what they said to one another. And Judge Walton is faced with conflicting testimony, right, between Mr. Johnson and Mr. Lathern. And he made a determination that Mr. Johnson was more credible than Mr. Lathern, in part because of his... of Mr. Lathern's past and his three felony convictions. Is that an unreasonable?
I would submit that is not a reasonable conclusion given all the evidence here. Not only did Judge Walton disbelieve, apparently, Mr. Lathern, but he also disbelieved the co-defendant who had an 11C1C disposition in his case post-trial, but he also, most importantly, disbelieved Tony Axum, another lawyer on the case with no interest in the outcome of these proceedings. A lawyer who, according to his testimony before Judge Lathern, reviewed his notes prior to his testimony, I would submit was careful and precise in his recollection, and most importantly, consistently said, I could never get word one from Gene Johnson about a plea, about a trial, about a strategy, or anything else.
Mr. Axum, am I right, never claimed to be in a meeting in which a conversation between Johnson and Lathern appeared over the plea, right?
The only times when Mr. Johnson testified about discussion of plea offers involved Mr. Johnson, Mr. Lathern, to the exclusion of all else. What I am submitting, Your Honor, is that the fact that Mr. Axum was adamant that he was never able to talk about a plea offer with Mr. Johnson, or anything else with Mr. Johnson, when Mr. Johnson says exactly the opposite, I was always talking to Mr. Axum about the case, is indirect evidence that supports Mr. Lathern that contradicts Mr. Johnson. I see that I am running out of time, and
I've got a couple more questions. First, John.
Okay.
I want to take you back to your argument that the district judge can't rely on his experience with or his assessment of the lawyer based on the judge's experience. Assume that issue is properly before us. How's that going to work? District judges, they're a group of lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, who appear regularly before our district judges. And so they get to know them really well over the years. And is it your position that, what, that they cannot in any way rely on their general assessment of the lawyer's credibility based on past experience? Is that your argument?
That's not my argument, Judge Tatel. What we have here is Judge Walton's express reliance not on Mr. Johnson's credibility from prior experience, but his practice. He usually never goes to trial.
Okay, but with respect to that, if that's your argument, then I mean, I actually think this is a pretty interesting issue, but I'm not sure it's raised here, because the fact that Judge Walton relied on here from Johnson's testimony, that is, that he rarely goes to trial, Johnson himself testified to. So, you know, it's kind of irrelevant. I mean, Johnson himself said, I only go to trial in less than 5% of my cases. He testified to that as a matter of fact. So I don't think your argument about the judge's relying on his experience really is raised here, because the fact was already in the record from Johnson's own testimony.
Johnson's own testimony was limited to the total number of new cases he had between 1979 and 2005.
His testimony was, you know, I plead most of my cases, right? And that's what Judge Walton's impression of his history was. It wasn't really any different.
I would beg to differ, Judge Tatel. I believe Mr. Johnson's testimony was the total number of new cases he had and the total number of criminal jury trials he had over the same time period. There was no testimony about all of these trials occurred on an even line average basis over those 26 years. They were all within the last 2 years. They were all in the first 2 years. There were numbers. But certainly a small percentage of Mr. Johnson's practice was trials, as reflected just by the numbers, 3,500, 3,800 new cases in 26 years, a fact which I would submit is bordering on, if not in fact, incredible. That's 135 to 146 new cases each year, every year, for more than a quarter century, and throw in 9 or 10 trials each year, every year, for the same quarter century, which I would submit supports our contention that Mr. Johnson didn't get on the stand and lie, as Judge Walton theorized. He was mistaken, and he was mistaken because of the press of other business, because he didn't remember, as he did not remember many other things in the course of his testimony, such as not even explaining acceptance of responsibility under the guidelines to Mr. Lathern at the time he's supposedly providing this plea. That made a huge difference to go from a 97-month sentence as imposed down at least 2, if not 3, offense severity levels, which would have saved him potentially 40 months out of 97 months.
All right. We'll give you some time. And
thank you.
Mr. Hill.
May it please the Court, John Hill for the United States.
Mr. Hill, before you begin, what if I were to say to you, Judge Walton is one of the best district judges in our circuit, which happens to be true, and I've never reversed him or never voted to reverse him. Therefore, you don't even need to argue because I know he's right. Now, that I couldn't do that. And how is that different from what Judge Walton said in this case?
Well, the question presumes that Judge Walton actually relied upon extra record evidence in this case, and the government submits that that's not the case. What actually happened is that Judge Walton, based on the record, mused aloud initially whether or not he could consider his experience with Attorney Johnson. There was no objection. The attorney's prosecutor offered his view on that. The judge made his findings without stating one way or the other whether he relied on it. Then at the certificate of appealability conference or hearing, Judge Walton made expressly clear that, and I quote him, I gave, he says, I am just not in the position to conclude based on the evidence that was presented. Even putting aside my history of Mr. Johnson, that the scales based upon the testimony that was presented tipped in favor of Mr. Lathern's evidence. And that's page 14 of the June 25th transcript. And so in this case, Your Honor, Judge Walton did not rely on extra record evidence. And so the question you've presented is not, we submit before you.
Well, he asked Lathern's counsel, how do I, if to any degree, consider my historical experience with Mr. Johnson? Then he also, and I don't have that in front of me, but he also had that thought about if you were lying, it would have been easier for you to lie and say there was never any plea offer. That goes to credibility. I mean, I just worry that he came close to vouching for him on the record. I know he cleared it up and said, even if I don't consider
That's
my
right.
experience with him, even if I don't consider that, I still believe him. So that it's, are you arguing it's harmless error at most?
Well, we're arguing for
your first argument is there's no error.
There's no error, and then if there is, it would be subject to a plain error review, as we've argued, because this issue was not properly raised. The error was not properly preserved in this case. But even if we were to go beyond that, Your Honor, there's a difference between a judge's generalized knowledge and a specific knowledge. And the government does not believe in this case that even though Judge Walton did have personal knowledge of this attorney, as judges often have in a case, they often have knowledge that's not in the record, whether it's because they suppressed evidence that doesn't make it in to the actual trial. But we don't assume that they can't compartmentalize that which is not permissible to consider from that which is permissible. And at most, the government submits in this case that the statements as to Attorney Johnson amount to nothing more than that I know this attorney, and based on the general knowledge that this attorney, Mr. Johnson, generally resolves cases by plea, that it would be inconsistent, absent extraordinary circumstances, that in the present matter, he would so denigrate the process of seeking pleas. Now, that general knowledge that if an attorney generally does take pleas, that in a particular case he would not be opposed to them, is not inappropriate to consider. And it's the burden of the appellant in this case to show why, because this is, again, the record evidence support this as well. When Attorney Johnson resolved most of his cases by plea, it's the appellant's burden to show that there's something extraordinary in this situation that would support him handling it differently.
The inconsistencies in Johnson's own testimony, and then you have the contradictions by the three other witnesses, at least one of whom is not a criminal, the defense counsel.
Your Honor, first of all, these credibility findings are reviewed under clear error review. So the question is not whether or not there's more evidence one way or the other. It's whether or not there's two plausible interpretations of what happened. And if so, the trial court's view cannot be overturned. But we disagree with this notion of three versus one. In fact, if anything, it's three versus one on the other side. You've got Attorney Johnson clearly stating that he conveyed a plea offer consistent with his general practice of resolving cases by plea. Then if you look at the sentencing hearing, you have the trial attorney prosecutor who said the same thing. She said that the only reason that she gave a plea offer in this case is because, quote, Mr. Johnson kept on asking me for a plea offer. So you have the trial prosecutor affirming essentially what Attorney Johnson said, what the trial court found, which is totally inconsistent with the notion that he would not be seeking a plea at all when the only reason a plea was offered was because of his efforts. Then you also have the co-defendant's testimony in this case. When describing the situation where Attorney Johnson and the appellant and the co-defendant are together discussing plea offers, he says, maybe we should take a cop. And they discussed with Attorney Johnson us not taking the cop and the reasons why we shouldn't take the cop. So you have this first person plural, and the only we that could be referring to is both appellant and the co-defendant. And so you've got three different statements here, all supporting the trial court's findings. And as for Attorney Axon, as appellant's counsel has acknowledged, he was not privy to the conversations in which the plea offer was conveyed. So whatever else he can testify to, what he cannot testify about is whether a plea offer was conveyed. And so in this case, we have a basic credibility determination, and it's well settled that those are entitled to deference and cannot be overturned unless based on an utterly implausible account of the evidence. Now, as for this question of whether there was extra record evidence, the trial court made clear that he did not rely upon any, and moreover, there's been no showing of plain error on that matter. The government submits that appellant has failed to meet his burden of establishing deficient performance in this case. Now, even putting aside deficient performance, there's also no prejudice. Appellant must show both. It's his burden to prove both deficient performance, which the trial court found there was not, and that ruling is entitled to great deference, but appellant must also show prejudice. And the trial court made two findings on this issue, which show that no prejudice was established. First, the district court said that I don't have any testimony indicating that appellant would have been willing to accept a plea that required that he receive a 70-month sentence. And in the hearing transcripts, appellant's counsel acknowledges as much, that that question was never asked. And so appellant has failed to show that he would actually have accepted the particular offer in this case. That's finding one. Finding two is that the trial court says on page 66 of the January 27th transcript, Mr. Lathern, from the inception, felt he could beat this case and was not interested in pleading guilty and took his chances, went to trial. So it's the trial court's finding that even if a plea offer had been offered in this case, assuming that Attorney Johnson failed to offer it, the appellant wouldn't have accepted it. And the record supports this.
Well, didn't the appellant say, I might have taken it, limited just to the plea, not to the 70 months?
He does say, yes, Your Honor.
I might have took it, or he said something.
He said that I would take a plea offer. However, there were two conditions to that plea offer that was actually offered in this case. The first was that he had to roll over on his co-defendant. There was absolutely no testimony that appellant would ever have done that. In fact, the only testimony on this point comes from co-defendant Ward, who says that appellant would never roll over on him. Secondly is, appellant gives two reasons why he would have allegedly accepted a plea offer. The first is, I'm guilty. And the second is, I receive a reduction in sentence based on acceptance of responsibility. Those two reasons hold true to pleading guilty to the indictment, which he did not do in this case. Appellant had twice pled guilty in previous cases. He knew how the process worked. He specifically testified that he was aware that by pleading guilty to the indictment in this case, he would receive acceptance of responsibility points. And in fact, if you look at the sentencing guidelines, had he have pled guilty, he would have been in no worse of a position than he was with the government's plea offer, and very likely would have been in a better position. If he had pled guilty early enough and been eligible for the three-point reduction in sentence, he would have been looking at a sentencing guideline range of 57 to 71 months, and he would have not had to turn over on his co-defendant. So as good as or better than the offer he actually received. And so it's inconsistent for him to say, oh, I would have accepted an offer, some theoretical any offer, regardless of the terms, regardless of the conditions imposed, when in fact he rejected the opportunity to plead guilty in this case to the indictment. Thank you.
Why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you. The question was raised whether or not Mr. Johnson could more easily have extricated himself from this dilemma by simply lying about how I never got a plea offer. The problem with that is, again, the November 16, 2005 sentencing transcript where the prosecutor at the time informs Judge Walton that she indeed provide a verbal, not written plea offer at a time between March 2, 2005, the status hearing, and prior to the time she filed her evidentiary 609 motion. That was all pre-trial. So one would have to expressly ignore a very clear statement, I provided a verbal plea offer, by the United States Attorney's Office. The extraordinary conduct involved with Mr. Johnson, I would submit, is that from the beginning, Mr. Johnson consistently, routinely, all the time, told Mr. Lathern he has a probability of winning this case at trial because he didn't know the location of the on-scene prosecution witnesses that would enhance Mr. Lathern's probability of an acquittal at trial. That was all Mr. Lathern heard from Mr. Johnson throughout the course of the case. Nothing about dispositions. So the inherent inconsistency, I suggest, is if Mr. Johnson is repeatedly telling Mr. Lathern, you're going to win a trial, why is he three times going to the prosecutor seeking a plea offer which we are told now required that he roll over, turn over on the co-defendant? The co-defendant's lawyer, Mr. Axum, was dying to have his client take a plea because he viewed the same evidence as Mr. Johnson and could see no reason to go to trial. He was the dependent characteristic in this case, if I may. Mr. Lathern was the principal defendant. The way it usually works, a factor that judges usually understand when dealing with criminal cases, is that the prosecutor starts at the bottom of the ladder, turns somebody over, and works their way up, not the other way down. The proposal only by Mr. Johnson, no one else beside Mr. Johnson says the plea offer required Mr. Lathern to turn over on the lesser defendant, Mr. Ward. The problem with that is it's inconsistent with the routine practice of criminal prosecutions.
All right, you need to wind it up.
All right. I would conclude by saying that both the deficient practice and the prejudice are addressed by Judge Hale in the Gaviria opinion, where we're talking about reasonable probability, not certainty, for acceptance by Mr. Lathern of a plea. And if the failure to provide accurate sentencing advice is a Strickland violation, I would submit that the failure to provide any plea offer altogether is similarly problematic. I recognize that Mr. Lathern and his witnesses have a difficult task convincing this court to reject the testimony of a lawyer in favor of another lawyer and two criminal defendants. I also suggest that mistakes are made, and one was made here, and it was not one without serious consequence to Mr. Lathern, who now just began his seventh year of incarceration on this case. I'd urge the court to reverse. Thank you.
Mr. Seidel, you were appointed to represent Mr. Lathern, and we want to thank you for your very able assistance.
Thank you very much.